NBC News Radio, I'm Mike Vaccara at the White House. Voters in France appear poised to change leaders as they cast presidential ballots today, angry over austerity policies to deal with the debt crisis. ITV reporter James Mates has more on the French elections.
If this was steeplechase, François Hollande will be approaching the final fence with a clear lead, and unless the polls have been wrong for months, the winning post in sight. All he has to do is avoid disaster.
Recent polls indicate Hollande, a socialist, will defeat Nicolas Sarkozy, who has served only one term. Greeks are also voting today in elections critical to getting international bailout support. Angry voters appear more than ready to punish both major parties for the country's economy. Indianapolis police say a 4-year-old boy apparently suffered multiple stab wounds. The child has died, and his 14-year-old cousin is being questioned. The teen was found covered in blood. Police say they have not arrested her, but the investigation is ongoing. This is NBC News Radio. Some victims' family members say they were angered as they watched the antics of the self-proclaimed September 11th mastermind and his co-defendants at their arraignment in Guantanamo Bay. The delays turned what should have been a 2-hour hearing into a 13-hour ordeal. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and 4 other men could be executed if convicted of murdering nearly 3,000 people. Efforts to legalize gay marriage have met some success this year, but could experience a setback on Tuesday if North Carolina votes to amend the state constitution to ban same-sex marriages and civil unions. Former President Bill Clinton can be heard on robocalls in the Tar Heel State, urging voters against Amendment 1.
The real effect of the law is not to keep the traditional definition of marriage. You've already done that. The real effect of the law will be to hurt families and drive away jobs. North Carolina can do better.
North Carolina is the only state in the Southeast without an amendment banning gay marriage. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
Hello, State Farm.
Hi, can I bundle my auto, home, and life policies together at State Farm?
You could save hundreds, and you can deal with just one State Farm agent.
Just one?
Just me.
I won't be bandied off to some bungling bargain basement bailiwick in East Bumstumble?
Nope, only me.
No BS, no baloney, and no ballyhooed bundling bunkum?
Believe it.
No matter how many policies you have, it can all stay with one State Farm agent.
Bless you.
Better?
Beyond better. Bye.
Bye.
Get to a better state. Call 1-800-STATE-FARM today.
Restore your vehicle's lost power by cleaning your entire fuel system with Chevron Techron Fuel System Cleaner. Right now at O'Reilly Auto Parts, buy one 12-ounce bottle for $7.99. Get the second one free. Chevron Techron Fuel System Cleaner. Buy one, get one free at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Limits apply. See store for details.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast, Sunday, May 6th. Join us live at 11 as Foodie and the Beast dives way deep into the Chef Awards at Pearl Dive, Jeff Black's hot new restaurant on 14th Street. Pearl Dive's a hell of a seafood restaurant, but that Sunday, Jeff is telling some of D.C.'s finest chefs to a chicken fried steak contest. Say what? Bertrand Barley's Kyle Bailey, Michelle Richard, The Source's Scott Druneau, Victor Albizo, and Bourbon Steak's Adam Sobel will take on Jeff as our esteemed panel of judges decides the winner, and you enjoy libations and great taste from Pearl Dive. For tickets and info, visit pearldivedc.com.
In the beloved fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly 1 in 3 children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov. Brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Ad Council.
You know, choosing how you listen to radio is important. If you don't visit HDRadio.com, you won't learn about the new local HD2, HD3 radio stations. If you don't hear the new local HD2, HD3 stations, you won't hear everything you should. If you don't hear everything you should, you won't understand what your friends are talking about. To understand what your friends are talking about, visit HDRadio.com to learn about HD radio receivers like the Pioneer DEH44 HD, now only $120 at Walmart.
I love my husband, but I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Ancuma of the Bank of America, and we have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Bill Carteau. Bill's the president and CEO of SPI, the Plastics Industry Trade Association. Brad Antle. Brad is the president and CEO of Salient Federal Solutions and also the chair of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. And Alan Becerra, president of PCMallGov. So let's get started. I'd like to introduce to you our first guest, a gentleman by the name of Bill Carteau, president and CEO of SPI, the Plastics Industry Trade Association. So, Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And what is SPI?
SPI is the trade association that represents the broad plastics industry. Plastics industry is about a $500 billion industry in the United States, third largest manufacturing sector. And SPI represents, as I said, the broad base, which means the machinery suppliers, the equipment manufacturers, the material suppliers, as well as the processors and recyclers that actually manufacture plastic products.
When you say represents, what does that mean?
We actually do lobbying for the plastics industry, promote the industry at industry events, as well as talk to the general public about the benefits of plastics.
Why are plastics so important?
Have a huge impact on our day-to-day life. If you think about what's going on from energy efficiency, cars would not be able to get to 35, let alone 50 miles per gallon by not being able to lightweight them with plastic. If you think from a medical profession standpoint, the medical industry wouldn't be in business today if it wasn't for plastics. Even stents that go in your blood vessels are actually made out of high tensile material. And if you think of food packaging, we actually can keep food fresher longer. And the plastics industry really helped eliminate botulism years ago by the can linings in cans today.
So no area of our life untouched.
Think about what you did when you got up this morning to brush your teeth. That's plastic.
How long has SPI been around?
This is actually SPI's 75th anniversary this year. We've been around since 1937.
Congratulations. And you have been the president and CEO for how long?
7 years now.
Okay, so we understand why plastics are so important to us. Why is running SPI so important to you? Why do this instead of a multitude of other things you could have done with your life?
You know, it's a great question. I've actually been in the plastics industry for 28 years and was running about a $500 million company before I came here. And I would have to say it comes back to my dad. My dad was born, raised, baptized, married, and ended up dying in the same community back in Indiana, and always gave an awful lot back to the community and spent his last 20 years of life being the Noble County Veteran Service Officer, and he's really the guy that that convinced me that this was the right thing to do to give back to the industry.
Name of the town is?
Avila, Indiana, northeast part of the state.
As big as Indianapolis?
Not quite. About 1,200 people. And it's really blossomed the last 52 years. It's about 2,000 now.
And what was life like back in Avila?
It was actually great. It was a small town, which as long as you want everybody to understand what you're doing, great from that standpoint. But my dad and my grandfather actually owned a business in town for 30 years. They actually owned a tavern. So,
really?
We knew everybody.
Well, what was life like growing up? I'm sure you didn't grow up in the tavern, but...
Well, I did on Sundays. I had to clean.
Well, what was that like?
It actually was a great experience. I actually lived in the country. We didn't farm, but my dad was actually a blue-collar worker, actually was an electrician, international harvester, and then worked third shift, and then came home and worked at the tavern and then slept in the afternoons and had dinner with the family and then went back to work a third shift. So I really ended up with that blue-collar, that Midwest work ethic because of my father.
Bill, did you mention in the green room that you were at one point even an auto mechanic?
I was. Very mechanically inclined because of my father. And none of my family went to college. None of my sisters. I'm the youngest of four and the only boy. My parents didn't go to college. And so I thought I wanted to be an auto mechanic. And I took vocational auto mechanics in high school. And when I got out, I worked for an Oldsmobile dealership for a year.
You don't sound like you were spoiled, but your aunt thought you were, right?
Yeah, my aunt definitely did. And it comes back to the point that I was the only boy. youngest of four children, and my aunt used to chase me around with a wooden spoon, and she made a comment one day that I would never amount to anything, and that was really a turning point in my life.
How so?
I had always kind of been a leader from the groups and things that I ran around with, and when my aunt told me that I was never going to amount to anything, it really stuck with me. And to this day, I still credit her for a lot of the tenacity that I have to actually get something done.
When you heard her say that, was there at any point that you believed it, or did it just fire you up, or what was the effect right at the moment?
As a young kid, I'm sure that it had, you know, that I thought about it because I told my mother, and years later, my aunt actually wrote her a letter, you know, kind of describing why she had said it and apologizing later. But, I think it probably hit me initially, but the only thing I remember from the experience is it fired me up to be the person that I am today.
Yeah. Well, when you weren't at the tavern, I understand you were at the gas station?
Through high school, I actually worked at a car wash gas station. There was no service department, and put myself through college, actually.
Pretty pivotal place, though, in your life, was it not?
From a couple reasons, absolutely.
Tell us more.
That gas station is actually where I met my wife while I was working there. She actually asked me out on our first date.
Your wife's name is?
My wife's name's Sherry.
And how did that happen? How did that go down?
One of the guys that actually worked at the gas station with me lived in an apartment building, a duplex home, and Sherry actually lived upstairs, and she came in, and he introduced me to her, and she was very cute. And, and so we would talk when she came in, and one day she came up to the car wash, and she rolled her window down, and she looked at me, and she said, "You want to go out sometime?" And I said, "Sure." She rolled her window right up, and later she would tell me that it was because I was taking too long to ask her out, and that's why she finally asked me out. And several years later, she actually asked me to marry her, so that's how, you know, she's got the same tenacity that I do.
Wow. So we understand how the gas station played a role in your personal life. What about your work life?
Significant from that standpoint. As I had said earlier, being an auto mechanic, I was into cars, and we had a regular customer that came in every Saturday afternoon. And this guy's name was Bill Dice. He was much older than I was, probably his late 50s at the time, and had a collection of Corvettes. And he would come in and during a slow period in the afternoons, and we'd start to talk. And he asked me one day, he said, what was I going to do with life? And by that time, I was actually in college. And I had actually started as a double E, electrical engineering major. And we got to talking, and he said, "Bill, when you get out of college, look me up. I'll have a job for you." I had no idea who the guy was. Finished college, went on into my career field and worked for a couple years. And lo and behold, one week, my old boss from the gas station called, and he says, "Bill, it's prom weekend, Saturday, can't get anybody of my regulars to work." He says, "Would you mind coming in and covering?" And I said, "Sure, I'll come in." Lo and behold, guess who shows up? Bill Dice shows up on Saturday afternoon. And, we hit it off immediately again, start talking. And he says, "I thought I told you to look me up. I'd have a job for you." Long story short, he wouldn't take no for an answer. And Tuesday of the next week, I had an interview. And I had a job offer by the time I walked out the door.
That's amazing. What did he see in you?
I think a couple things. It was an opportunity for a sales position, and he saw the fact that I was very good with people, and he also sensed, and he told me this later, the drive and determination that I had to succeed in life, and this had come up through a lot of our conversations that we'd had at the gas station, and the guy that he worked for, which was a $100 million privately held company, and Bill was number two, which I didn't realize that. Chet Decco ended up being a key mentor for me in life, and Chet always said he'd rather have drive and determination over raw intelligence any day, and thank God that was the case because I'm not the smartest guy on the block.
I'm guessing you have a lot of both. Do you still go back to the gas station ever when you go back to Indiana?
Unfortunately, they tore it down and built an auto parts store there a few years ago, so I guess it still goes back to my roots of loving cars.
I mean, I'm guessing this must have been a great place for guys to want to work because they meet their future wives, they get their future employers.
I probably shouldn't say it, but I at one point in time, there was a Burger King next door and a Richard's restaurant across the street, and I dated every girl that was there.
Tell us a little bit about DeMag Industries. It was a pivotal point in your life when you made a decision that changed the rest of your life. Tell us about that.
Okay. I had actually been working for Chet Decco and this Group Decco company that Bill Dice had got me into. I'd actually been there for 5 years and left, and then I came back to the organization. And I was running one of their divisions, a machinery company in the plastics industry. And I'd grown it to about a $25 million company as the president. Had an opportunity to go to work in the Cleveland, Ohio area. And I went into a much larger company that about $210 million as VP of marketing, with the understanding that the then CEO was going to retire sometime in the future. 4 years later, he ends up retiring. Well, he hadn't run the company all that well. And we were losing double-digit millions of dollars. And we had a brand new CEO in Germany. And his decision was, based on how the company's track record the last few years, there was probably no one internally that should be CEO of the company. And, you know, when I found out Jerry was retiring, I ended up calling Germany and talked to the guy, our legal counsel in charge of HR, and I said, you know, what's going to happen? He says, we're not interviewing anybody internally. It's only external. Well, being the guy that I am, I wasn't going to take no for an answer. And so I had a trip to Germany scheduled, and I worked with the secretary to the new CEO to get a meeting set up with him and have dinner with him while I was in Germany. At the last minute, he canceled the meeting. I then knew that he was going to the States, and I was headed back the following day. So I finagled a 20-minute meeting with him over breakfast prior to his meeting then in Cleveland that same day. And during that 20-minute period of time, and I probably only had 10 because he was on the phone a lot back and forth with Germany, I had 10 minutes to convince him to throw my name in the hat, and I convinced him to do that.
Okay, you got to give us the details because you need to tell us what you told us in the green room. How'd you do it?
Well, that wasn't the actual meeting where this happened, but during that meeting, I convinced him that I was an outsider. I wasn't one of the inside guys. You know, that I had seen all these changes that needed to be made to the company, but my boss wouldn't allow those to happen. So I made it to the cut to be able to be interviewed. And in my interview with these guys, I had actually put together a presentation, and it was about 12, 13 pages long. And what I did is I laid it out into three areas. I laid it out of who's Bill Cartel. I laid it out what the problems with the company are, and what needed to be changed. And then the third thing was what I would do my first 100 days. And so when we're sitting down at this meeting, and it was actually a dinner meeting, the new CEO looked at me and he says, Bill, I want you to cover three things tonight over dinner. He says, I want you to tell me, you know, who you are and a little bit more about you. He said, I want you to tell me what's wrong with the company. He says, then I want you to tell me what you would do in the first 90 days. Reached underneath my chair, pulled it out, and I said, well, if you let me go through this, I'll answer those questions. He couldn't have teed it up any better. Wow. And I walked through that, and later that evening, the headhunter was at the table with these other two guys, called me in my room and says, Bill, you not only hit a home run, you hit it out of the park. He said, that was absolutely amazing.
Wow.
And long story short, 28 people that they interviewed globally, I ended up with the president and CEO job.
I bet your aunt was absolutely glad that she was wrong about you.
I think that's when she wrote the letter to my mother. To be perfectly honest with you.
Wow. Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for SPI?
It is www.plasticsindustry.org.
Give it to us one more time. Don't want anybody to miss it.
www.plasticsindustry.org.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Bill Cartel. Bill's the president and CEO of SPI, the Plastics Industry Trade Association. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Lancuma of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Bill. And Michael and I will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Rick Palmer.
Rick, who are you with?
I'm the Vice President of Business Development with Integrity Management Consulting.
What is Integrity Management Consulting?
Integrity is a rapidly growing small business here in McLean, and we're proud to be ranked as one of the top fastest growing companies in the local area and in the state of Virginia.
What kind of work do you do, in just a few words?
We do acquisition planning and program management support.
For the federal government?
For the federal government.
Okay. Now, you're not here really to talk too much about what Integrity does. You're here to do some celebrating. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
What are you celebrating?
Well, we've just been named one of Virginia's fantastic 50 companies for 2012. We're one of the fastest growing companies in the state of Virginia, and we're going to be receiving that award very shortly.
Tonight?
Yes.
Fantastic. You're also one of the seven precious jewels?
Yes, we were just named one of Consulting Magazine's seven small jewels for 2012 as one of the fastest growing companies in the area.
But we're not done yet, are we?
No, absolutely not.
There was one more thing you were going to celebrate.
We have a good nationwide presence, and particularly in the southwestern United States. We just opened a field office in Fort Worth, Texas, where a lot of our business is.
You're able to accomplish all these things because you're able to focus and compete effectively in a full and open environment. How are you able to do that, in a few words?
Well, how we're able to do that is just the fact that we evolved our company very, very quickly. The founders and the owners did that, and quite honestly, we just did not attempt to do all things all at the same time. Focused on some great areas and built the business where we could.
We've been speaking with Rick Palmer of Integrity Management Consulting, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius and from Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Ankuma of the Bank of America. And we have a great great guest for you. Next up is Brad Antle. Brad is the president and CEO of Salient Federal Solutions. He's also the chair of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. So, Brad, welcome to the show. And tell us, what is Salient Federal Solutions?
Salient Federal Solutions is an IT service provider in the federal space, both to civilian and DOD and intelligence communities.
And you're not any old IT provider. You are, what, to use your words, a life or death IT provider. What does that mean?
Well, certainly life or death IT is one of those kinds of distinctions that we have, because we're not afraid to focus on systems that really do impact people's life or death. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. In theater, we help support a system called CRAM, which is Counter Rocket Artillery and Munitions. And it lets folks know who are in forward operating bases of an incoming munition, rocket or mortar, so that they can take cover before that thing hits. So literally, if it doesn't work, then lives are in jeopardy.
So I'm curious, so how much lead time, for example, would they get so that they can make preparations to clear out or whatever they would do?
Well, it really depends on what's coming in, but 10 to 15 seconds. So they have enough time to take some form of cover. But we also do mass notification systems in military compounds. So for instance, if you remember Fort Hood.
Yes.
Had Hassan gone outside with a weapon, could have impacted many more people with his terror, because there was really no way on that base to let people know that there was something going on. So we install systems that allow broad notification.
Wow, that's important work, and we appreciate you doing it. How big or small is Salient?
Salient is about $250 million in revenue, about 1,100 employees.
And you've been around for 2 years?
Coming up on 2 years.
$250 million and 1,100 employees in 2 years?
And growing.
How'd you do that?
Well, we started by acquiring a platform company of about $100 million, and that was our start. That was back in 2010, in the mid-year, end of June. And we've been growing that. That has grown nicely. We've done three other acquisitions as well.
Sounds like you're just getting started.
We are. We have a goal to hit $1 billion by 2018.
I don't doubt that you will. When in the green room, when I asked you, why do you do this work, your quote was, there's no greater need, end quote. What do you mean by that?
Well, frankly, I think we all see the budget imperatives today that exist in our federal government. Our deficits are growing. I truly believe that it's only through the application of technology that we can rein in government spending by putting the efficiencies in place that are necessary so that we aren't doing things in a people-based, labor-intensive method. It costs too much money.
In the green room, you indicated that at one point in your career, you were told at 30 you were too old to be a CEO of a company. Can you tell us about that and how you've made it here today?
Yeah, well, I have to admit that was General Electric that told me that. So, clearly they thought at 30 I didn't have enough runway to get the experience necessary to be CEO by 45, which is in GE where they want you to be ready. They still liked me, but they didn't think I could make it to CEO. Frankly, I hadn't thought about being CEO until that moment in time.
Tell us about that list of the top 1,500 and kind of unpack that a little bit for those who don't know a little bit about how GE works.
So GE goes through an annual succession planning process every year. It's rigorous, and they really try to call what they consider the highest potential, highest performing individuals at all levels in the company. And then they focus attention on them to help them get the right assignments, get the right training. And frankly, I don't know any company that does training better than General Electric for leadership training.
Now, you were in you were on the list, were you not, of the top 1,500?
I was.
However, they told you too old at 30 to be CEO.
Too old to be CEO, but not too old to run a division. So they certainly wanted to continue to groom me for some reasons.
But that was not ultimately good enough for you. To run a division.
Well, like I said, I didn't think about that I would necessarily want to be CEO of anything at that point in time. But when they told me I couldn't, I was too old in GE parlance to be a CEO, then I realized at that point I did really want to run something.
Wow, interesting.
And so GE was not going to be the long-term answer for me.
Yeah. Well, let's go back in time. Where are you from?
Well, I was born in New England, in Groton, Connecticut.
And you grew up and spent your whole life there?
No, I my father was in the Navy, and back then it was very, very common to be rotated every year or two, so we moved around all over the place.
By the time you were in sixth grade, you were at how many schools?
I've been in five different schools by the time I was in sixth grade.
Did you enjoy the variety of that?
Yeah, I don't think anybody enjoys that kind of variety. You know, as you, it takes about 6 months or so to make some friends, to really make some good friends, and then six more months you cultivate them, and at the end of that 6 months you're losing them again. So as a child, it was very difficult to lose friends every year.
Tell us about the first day of school each year.
Well, you walk into a classroom, you know absolutely nobody in that classroom. You have no friends, nobody that you've associated with generally. So everybody in the classroom is a total stranger. And the first thing you need to do is try to cultivate a friend or two. So you're quickly trying to size everybody up and figure out who you can potentially make friends with.
Yeah, you must have been exceptional at something for you to make friends quickly. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I'm not exceptional at much. So I think all you learn is to be very adaptive. So when you're ripped out of so many environments, you learn quickly to adapt to other people.
How's that helped in your business career, especially with you running the Northern Virginia Technology Council? And that's a big organization.
It is a big organization. NVTC has almost 1,000 member companies. I think I'm not necessarily an extrovert. That's not my nature. But I think I learned as a child that you have to make the effort to reach out to other people, to make connections. And I think it helps me in business. It helps me in places like NVTC.
How is running NVTC different than running Salient, for instance?
Well, NVTC is an association, so it's not a company. We have different objectives than a traditional company. It's not profit and loss. Mm-hmm. We have member constituencies that we try to support and service. So it's more a coalition. You're coalescing a group towards a set of objectives. In a company, it's very clear. CEO sets the vision. You execute that vision, and you try to get everybody excited about that.
Is one easier to run than the other, or just different?
I think a company is easier to run because you get to focus around a very clear and concise vision. An association has to be ever adaptive to the members' needs. So as they change, you have to be willing to change.
Yeah, very interesting.
Can I take you back? Your dad was in the Navy, and you followed in his steps, but you didn't stay that long. Can you tell us a little bit about why that was?
Sure. My father, first of all, was Navy, and my brother was Naval Academy, as was my father. I have two brother-in-laws, Naval Academy. I liked the Navy, but I didn't want to go to the Naval Academy. By that point, I knew way too much. Naval Academy is one of those places that you never go to if you know what goes on there, I don't think. So it's best for the uninitiated.
What does that mean? That's very mysterious.
We hear all kinds of stories about the hazing and harassment and rigor, and it just didn't sound, and it was all men, and frankly, I was dating at the time, so it didn't really sound attractive to me at all. But my father passed away when I was 15. A lot of respect for the military. We grew up in that environment, so I knew I wanted to go into the Navy, so I did that after college.
Yeah. What was it like losing your dad at 15?
Tough. I mean, as a 15-year-old, I think that's when you rely on your dad probably more. But we did so much together growing up in hunting, doing repairs on cars and around the house. So I learned a lot from him in a very short period of time.
Did someone fill the gap? I'm guessing no one could fill it completely, of course. But did someone step up or step in?
Not really. I mean, my older brother was 11 years older. He was already off and doing his own thing. So there really was nobody.
Yeah. Let's go back to the Navy for a moment. You said you liked the work, but ultimately you decided not to stay. Why?
I did. After 8 years, I made the decision that I wanted to get out of the Navy because, frankly, I didn't see the reward for the effort. It didn't really matter if you gave 110% or you gave 80%. You're going to make rank pretty much the same time everybody else does. You get the same pay. There's no bonus, no reward mechanism. So long term, I didn't see the return for the effort. But I loved the organization.
Yeah.
So even when I got out, I stayed in the reserves and completed another 22 years in the reserves.
Did your time in the Navy also help you going back with what you do now and your commitment to the federal government and providing the sort of efficiencies you do? Would you say some of that derived from your service in the Navy and what you saw and how you worked?
I think so. My last 3 years in the Navy were as a project engineer for a combat system. So I truly enjoy the work. Although I have to admit, when I left the Navy, I didn't really want to go to work as a government contractor. They just had a bad, it wasn't what I wanted to do. I didn't realize when I went to work for GE that they actually did work for the government. So, my bad.
You mentioned that the reward system is in the Navy wasn't what you had hoped it'd be, so you left. I'm guessing there was a lot of rewards for you at Lockheed, but you left Lockheed also. Why'd you leave Lockheed?
I did. Well, I was at a point in my career where I either needed to move my family to get the right kind of promotion to either Orlando or Denver, or leave the company. So I'm sort of up or out kind of guy. So yeah. If I wasn't willing to move up, take on more responsibility, then I had to leave. And I left that decision up to my wife. So I said to my wife, do you want to leave? Do you want to move to Orlando or Denver, or would you rather stay here? And her decision was to stay in Northern Virginia, where we had two kids and where she wanted to raise them in this area.
So what'd you do?
So I left the company. And I had been talking with Ray Olson, who was had a business idea without money at the time to form a company called SI International. Yeah. And we kept talking. I said, well, I can't afford with a young family to leave Lockheed until you have something going. So once he did the first acquisition, he convinced me to come over and run that. And then after that, we did 8 more acquisitions, took the company public. I took over as CEO down the road, and we got acquired in 2008. So it was a great run.
And that was your predecessor, obviously, to Salient.
That was.
You know, a moment ago, you said you're an up or out kind of guy. And as I think about your life story, I think about the military, up or out. I think about GE, up or out. What happens next? What's the up or out?
The up is $1 billion.
Yeah.
And then maybe we go public and we take it further. Who knows? But I mean, my immediate objective is to get the company on the right trajectory, which I think it is, to hit that billion-dollar target by 2018.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for Salient Federal Solutions?
You bet. It's www.salientfed.com.
Would you spell it?
Yes. SAILENTFED.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Brad Antle. Brad is the president and CEO of Salient Federal Solutions. He's also the chair of the Northern Virginia Technology Council. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mike Lancuma of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Brad. And we will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and a chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners who want to be better at what they do and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at it. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Andy Saunders of Clifton Larson Allen, and it's our pleasure to introduce our next guest. His name is Mark Cardesi. Mike is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Global Network Services. So, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And tell us, what is Global Network Services?
Global Network Services is an IT services company, web applications, IT services, application development, and that sort of thing.
Can you give us a very specific example of what you do?
One of the things we do is a case management software for the Air Force, where we make sure the folks who are putting in a case, somebody who feels that they were harassed or something wrong with what the way they were being treated, that their process is has been taken care of in a quick and efficient manner, and that they are they feel like they've been taken care of. Honestly,
so if I'm in the Air Force and I've got an EEO case about me, what are you doing for me?
I'm making sure that you're getting adjudicated properly. I'm making sure that any of your rights are being taken care of on the civil side, and the military side, that you're following military justice.
Wow, that's important work. Thank you for doing it. Mm-hmm. How big or small is your company?
We're just under $10 million.
And you're the co-founder. When did you co-found the firm?
1996.
Why did you do that?
I had an issue with authority. And I had a
such as
I had a director of IT who didn't know anything about IT, and so my suggestions kind of fell on deaf ears. And I felt that it'd be easier for me to go out and do this kind of a job on my own.
So lots of people have authority figures who, for some reason, don't measure up, but they don't all start companies. Well, why you?
I just thought it'd be easier. I wouldn't have to deal with a boss and that sort of thing. And it turns out I was wrong.
How so?
Well, it turns out that every customer in the world that I have is my boss. So instead of getting away from bosses, I multiplied them by an exponential number.
So how is it easier now to deal with many bosses than just one boss before?
Well, I'm always trying to give that value add, or the value for value kind of work for the IT services. So it doesn't matter how many bosses you have. You're always focused on what you're trying to do is the right thing from a technology standpoint, and it's what we decide is the right thing.
You wanted to do the right thing when you were young. You had an example of that?
I did. When I was in middle school, I was on the bus with a buddy of mine, and he defaced one of the bus seats. And being the outgoing person that I am, everybody knew who I was but didn't know who he was. And we were brought down to the principal's office. And the principal and the security officer were in one room kind of, you know, throwing the spotlight on me and giving me a lot of pressure on giving up my buddy, and I couldn't do it.
Why not?
It's that you know, you're a kid, you've got buddies, you don't want to turn your buddy in, you want to do the right thing, but on the other hand, you don't want to be a rat or, you know, give up a friend.
Did your buddy think that you'd rat him out, or was he confident you'd keep your mouth shut?
Oh, I'm sure he knew that I'd keep my mouth shut.
Yeah. So what happened?
Well, while I was in the office there, and under this this spotlight from the principal, I actually asked to talk to my dad, which kind of threw them off, because that was one of the things that they used to try and pressure kids into give them information.
So are you sweating bullets, or are you cool as a cucumber?
No, I'm sweating. These two guys are yelling at me, and well, yelling's not proper, but probably raised voices and trying to pressure me into giving the information, because, you know, they're the principal, they're the security officer, they're going to get the information out of me.
So you get your dad on the phone.
So I get my dad on the phone, and I tell him one of my buddies, quote-unquote, had done this, and I knew who it was, but I didn't feel right about giving it up. Of course, he knew immediately, since he knew all my friends, he knew immediately who it was, and he asked me, and I said yes. And he said, well, why don't you go talk to your buddy? I will get these guys off of you for a little while.
So your dad's on the phone, and you Correct. Handed the phone to the principal.
Correct. He said, let me talk to the principal, and I'll let them let you go.
What'd your dad say?
He told them that my son's going to go talk to the boy who did this, and he's going to see if he can get him to turn himself in.
So what'd you do?
I handed the phone over. I went down. I talked to my buddy, and my buddy was good enough that when I told him that I got caught for it, I didn't tell him that he was on the ropes or anything, but when I told him I got caught, he was willing to turn himself in.
They let you off the hook?
They let me off the hook totally.
What does that say about you, Mike?
Well, I mean, it was really an issue about my dad, who had my back no matter what. Even though I was involved in this, I wasn't doing it directly, but I was still involved. He supported me, and he didn't throw me under the bus or my buddy under the bus. He let me try and figure this out with him.
Did you know your dad would have your back?
You know, in the back of my mind, I did. I mean, I knew that I could always call him, and he'd always give me the right answer.
Was there another time that happened to in your life with your dad?
Well, one of the other times would be when I was just out of high school, and I finished all my honors courses, and I'd been working really hard. It was the last my senior year, and I, at the end of the year, had this job. It was a $8 an hour job, and I knew that that was a lot of money back in the 80s or mid 80s. And I went to him and I said, you know, I'm not going to college. Even though I got accepted, I'm not going to college. This is what I'm going to do. And my father didn't give me a hard time about it. He just said, okay. And then at the end of the summer, when I woke up early one morning and met him at the door as I was leaving, he said, "Where are you going so early?" And I said, "I got to go register for classes." And he never gave me a hard time about it. A couple years later, I asked him about it, and he said, "Well, I knew that you'd do the right thing, a summer out in the sun working out laboring and that sort of thing would teach you that working with your mind is better than working with your back sometimes."
So what characteristics do you now possess as a result of your dad or these experiences?
Well, education, number one. More education is always better. The more I can, I'm always learning. As you know, a company owner, you're always trying to learn new things, trying to get advisors, that sort of thing. But secondarily, supporting my people, supporting my family, and always basically having their back.
Mike, you have a commitment to community service and are being awarded for that here in Fairfax County. Can you tell us more about that?
I've been involved with the Northern Virginia Technology Council's foundation since it was a committee back in 1997. And all of that work, I was noticed earlier a couple months ago. The Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce asked if they could nominate me for their service award for Executive of the Year, and I said okay.
You probably get some pretty good PR out of that, don't you?
Yeah, I do, and I've shied away from a lot of these kinds of awards. A couple people brought them to me and said I should self-nominate and that sort of thing, and I don't like that sort of thing. I'm doing this. Most of the stuff I do is for kids, and I do it because I enjoy kids, and I want to try and help my community.
Yeah, in the green room when I started to talk to you about this stuff, you would barely give me any information about it because you wanted to be so low-key. Well, why is that?
Yeah, I just I've always wanted to, since the start of my company. I started in 96. I started giving back to the community in 97. That's always been a part of my life, and I do it because I love doing it. The enjoyment, what I get out of it is I get to see these young folks do better or get more education or learn something.
So just you and your company is devoted to community service or other people as well?
No, I really try and push everybody to be involved in the community someplace. They don't have to do that, but I try and do it by leading, and I try and bring them involved with the things that I'm doing, my pet projects, where they can or will support their projects.
What's the hardest thing you've ever had to do, Mike?
The hardest thing I had to do was fire the first person that I hired in my company when I started.
So back in 1996, there were how many people to start?
I started with one person.
Just you and this other person.
And a few years later, I ended up having to fire that person.
Okay, well, tell us about that.
Well, I had this kind of utopian idea of how I was going to run a company, kind of very transparent, very open. Everybody's in essence a partner in the company trying to make the company do better and go forward, and it seems that just wasn't going to work. I mean, I tried, and some people have just a pure employee mentality, and you know, they didn't want to do those extra little things the customer needed, and I've always been a kind of a value for value kind of person. You're going to pay me, I want to make sure that you get the value out of it. And if it means that I have to stay a little bit after or I have to put a little extra into it, mm-hmm. then that's what I'm going to do.
So how'd you do it?
How did I fire him?
Yeah.
I took him to a restaurant, and I sat down, and I said, here's the issues, and we're going this way. This is what my vision is. This is the direction we're going in, and it doesn't seem like that's your vision, and we need to part ways.
How did he or she respond?
Just total dismay. I expected some kind of anger or fight, yeah, or something like that, but there was just a kind of a look like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that you did this.
How did that feel to you to make that decision?
It took me a month once I realized that was the direction I had to go in to make the decision. It took me a month, and then once I had decided to do it, it probably took me 2 days to get up the courage to set up the schedule, just because I brought this fellow in, and I had known him for years beforehand, and we had a great relationship, and he was an older fella. He had taught me some stuff, and now I had to let him go. It was terrible.
You mentioned early in the interview that you started your company because you have a problem with authority. You're in authority now. It doesn't sound like you have a problem using it wisely.
I try and do the most correct thing at each crossroads, and I think about it as much as I can to try and make the right decisions. I can't say that I've always made them, but I try my best.
Would you give us the web address, please, for Global Network Services, Mike?
Sure. www.gogns.net.
Okay, let's do that again. I want to make sure everybody catches it slowly this time, please.
www.gogns.net.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Mike Cardassi. Mike is the co-founder, president, and CEO of Global Network Services. I'd like to thank my co-host, Dondi Saunders of CLA, Clifton Larson Allen, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Mike. And Dondi and I will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Michael Ankuma of the Bank of America. And we're joined by our next guest. His name is Alan Becerra. Alan is the president of PC Mall Gov. So welcome to the show, Alan. And what is PC Mall Gov?
PC Mall Gov is an IT product and services provider to public sector customers that spans the customers from education to state, local, and federal governments and healthcare.
So can you tell us a little bit about the name PC Mall Gov? What does all that mean?
PC Mall Gov is owned by a parent company that's PC Mall, which started in the consumer world, as the name might indicate. PC Mall is located in California. PC Mall Gov is a subsidiary of PC Mall. And over the years, we have clearly evolved from just selling PCs and Macs to selling services, providing data center consolidation, consulting, and anything from one unit all the way to a data center.
Give us an example. You used the Library of Congress example in the green room. Tell us about that.
Well, the Library of Congress, as the average listener might not realize, the Library of Congress has on record anything from what's been written on paper that goes through not just what Congress handles, government records, music industry, songs that were written on a piece of paper or even on an album. We have a contract which is outsourced to us. We have people on staff who help design a solution to digitize anything from paper or media all the way to a modern-day storage, where it can be accessible by anyone inside of a library. You go in and you say, I want to have a record of X, then you can have access to that.
Now, all of these records, they're stored somewhere, are they not?
Yeah, they're stored in a location that's not necessarily to be disclosed, on a mountainside, which it was actually, it's a pretty neat story. The founder, one of the founders of Hewlett Packard, David Packard, donated a building in a mountainside here in Virginia, away from Washington, D.C. where it is state-of-the-art. When you drive by, you can never tell. It's actually covered by ivy from outside.
Wow. Have you ever been there?
I've been there under a great deal of scrutiny and escort.
Well, we're not going to ask you on the air where it is because we don't want you to have to kill us. How big or small is PC MullGov?
PC MullGov is a $200 million business. That's our business is roughly split between $110 million to federal and $90 million to state and local and education customers.
And it's been around for how long?
We were founded in 2002, right before I joined the company. I joined in April of 2002.
Well, where are you from?
I'm originally from Lebanon. I was born right outside of East Beirut.
And you've been in the U.S. since when?
I've been in the U.S. For 32 years now, most of my adult life since 1980.
What was going on in 1976 when you were still in Lebanon?
Lebanon was going through a civil war that actually begun around 73-74 time frame and lasted until 1989. So at that time, it was subject to a sectarian war, otherwise a religious war, where a couple of hundred thousand people were actually lost their lives during that civil war. Put it in context, Lebanon is a population is 5 million people or more or less.
In 1976, you were 15 years old, and you were dating a girl.
That's right.
And tell us about, just to give us a flavor for what life was like
well,
back then.
Clearly at the time, when you're looking at a small country with sectarian war, there was there were areas that were occupied by one side or the other, yeah. And you were not to cross into the other side.
Well, when you say occupied, well, just people living there, or there was an occupation force?
Well, in a simplistic terms, you have the population of a country like Lebanon is split between Christians and Muslims with some variations on in each of the sects, where you would have one area that's predominantly Christian and another area predominantly Muslim.
Yeah.
So as a result, the country was effectively divided. If you think of Cyprus, where you have Cyprus, yeah, was divided between the Turks and the Greeks.
So you're dating a girl in an, yeah, occupied country.
Right, and she happened to live on the other side.
And what does that mean, the other side? Like the other side of guard stations or the other side of
there
what?
Was at the time, there was one of the stages that the country went through by mandate of the Arab League and the United Nations. They called the Syrian army in to put an end to the war, to the civil war. And, you know, naively you could believe that actually was the agenda.
Yeah.
So the Syrians actually sided with one side, naturally was the Muslims, and they set up roadblocks. And if you cross these roadblocks, your life was in jeopardy. Some people went missing, some people went dead or dismembered.
And your girlfriend lived on the other side of these roadblocks?
Yes, she did.
So what'd you do?
Well, I had a date, and I decided to keep that commitment, which is a personal flaw of mine. So I actually made that date, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was on my way back home. I got stopped, and I was interrogated, and I was subject to some physical abuse. And in layman's terms, I was actually beat up.
Wow.
And I was, after a couple of hours, I was let go, and which I felt very fortunate. And I moved on away from the roadblock. It took pulled off to the side for a couple of hours to recollect myself, yeah, and be able to just function as a human being and just moved on.
So fast forward a few years later, someone is extremely happy to put you on a plane and get you out of there, and there are folks taking bets on what would happen after that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was at the time, I was actually 22 years old. It was in 1980, and the war was still actually in full swing with some ebbs and flows, but still the same environment. Schools had been shuttered, colleges were closed. Very little of normal life actually functioned. You really didn't have much of a future. So I haven't been one of 7 children. I was the youngest. So I had an opportunity to come here. I was sponsored by one of my brothers who lived in the States in this area. He sent me a green card, and I was happy to get that. I get on an airplane, but having lived in a small town, many friends, many relatives, they knew how attached I was to that environment. They were placing bets that I wouldn't last maybe 30 days. Here we are 32 years later. I'm sitting here. So I landed in JFK so many hours later. I think I connected through Brussels at the time.
What were the early days like?
In the U.S., it was like a fog. I mean, you come in, and I came into this country, and I learned English here on just by living, immersing in the culture.
Tell us a little bit about why that was so difficult. Most people in your country are brought up to be bilingual, are they not?
That's right. In Lebanon, you're fortunate that the school system actually mandates two languages, Arabic and whether a choice, English or French. And it wasn't really a choice. If you happen to live in one region, it was Arabic and English and French, and in the other region it was Arabic and English. So I happened to live in the area where I learned Arabic and French. So coming to the United States, my vocabulary in English consisted maybe of 20, 30 words tops.
Yeah.
So coming in here to try to function, my brother-in-law, my brother and his family were fully American. There was no Arabic spoken in that household.
Wow.
So you had to function. So during the day, just as mundane as having to order lunch at a fast food restaurant,
yeah.
Things that we take for granted as Americans today, you walk up, and thankfully there were numbers next to each combo, so you ordered by number to avoid any kind of questions and what kind of variation do you want. If somebody asks you if you want mayo, you go, what's mayo? lettuce, and so on. So.
You've obviously lived through a civil war, yet when you were asked what was one of the hardest things you'd ever done in your life, when we asked you that in the green room,
yeah.
You said demoting your own boss.
Right.
Tell us that story.
Well, a few years back, my background, obviously, in this industry is known. I've been in the IT industry for 32 years since I came to this area. So I would rather not mention the company or the individual.
Certainly.
But at one point during my career, there was a gentleman who was in a significant position who had some failures on their watch, and a great deal of discussion ensued by the board and top management. And this individual was actually in top management. What do we do? What should we do? How do we break the news? And so on. And so at the time, the board was actually interviewing a number of us to get to the heart of the story. And they said, well, we've reached a conclusion that we want to either let this individual go or transition out. And, you know, we can't figure out how we break it to them. I volunteered to break it to them.
Yeah.
And I sat down and had an hour and a half, very painful conversation. Right. At the end, we ended up with a hug.
Wow.
That individual was later demoted and finally kind of left the company on somewhat amicable terms, but ended up leaving.
Yeah. In just a few words, are you Lebanese? Are you American?
I'm American.
And that, in just a few words, what does that mean?
My family's American. I'm very much committed to this country. I'm very proud of what this country stands for. And I'm very proud of my accomplishment in this country because I had opportunities I did not have or couldn't have had where I came from.
Yeah. Would you please give us the web address for PCMallGov?
Yes, it's www.pcmallgov.com.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Alan Becerra. Alan is the president of PCMallGov. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Bill Carteau, president and CEO of SPI, the Plastics Industry Trade Association, Brad Antle, president and CEO of Salient Federal Solutions and the chair of the Northern Virginia Technology Council, and of course, most recently, Alan Becerra, president of PCMallGov. I'd like to thank my co-host, Michael Ancuma of the Bank of America, for helping me with the interviews today. More than anyone else, thank you to you, the listening audience. If it were not for you, we would not even have a radio show. So thank you so very much for listening. Thank you also to the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us today. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Alan. And this has been your host, Mike Mannion. I'm with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. One more time, thank you so very much for listening. And until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news this paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements.